Thank you for attending session 252, titled Freedom, Resilience, Empowerment, and Newfound Identity. As you listen today to Alyssa's remarks, think on all the ways that our Mormonism impacts our identity, whether we are in or out of the church. For many years, Alyssa, who had been raised within the FLDS to believe that marriage was the pinnacle of a woman's achievement, she was routinely raped and sexually assaulted by her husband. By the age of 17, she had suffered miscarriages and a stillborn child. At her lowest point, she attempted suicide. What she couldn't know is that through an act of bravery and escape, she would end up taking down cult leader Warren Jeffs and starting a ripple of change that would forever change and liberate the FLDS. After her liberation, she returned to her community and now leads change and empowerment for her people. This presentation will discuss the lessons she's learned about embracing an identity in and out of her religious community. Alyssa Wall is a former member of the FLDS Church who was forced into marriage at age 14. She left the FLDS at age 18 and began the difficult journey to freedom. Alyssa is now a thriving entrepreneur, author, speaker, and advocate. She lives in southern Utah with her two children. Please remember to turn off your cell phones. And Alyssa, I'll turn it to you.
Wow, you guys are truly a beautiful sight. And, oh, can you hear me? I have to get really close, don't I? Okay, this is good. I like the sound of my voice. No, thank you so much for having me here today. I know that you guys could be anywhere in the world today, but you choose to be here. And you choose to honor as I choose to speak. And I am excited to connect with you. I kept telling myself, the right people are going to be in this room, and we are going to connect, and we are going to grow and learn together. And I'm excited to have the opportunity to share with you. When I was preparing for this, Lindsay, my dear friend Lindsay, convinced me to go ahead and present, which I'm excited to do. I was going to be so professional. I was going to have a PowerPoint and a really great handout that you guys could take home and realize that was the best 90 minutes of your life. And I couldn't get it done. I kept fighting it and thinking, how can I tell these people something that I'm not? This panic of, why would they ever want to hear me? What do I have to share that brings value in their life? And I have a very dear friend who happened to walk me through this moment of complete meltdown. And I'm telling her, I don't have anything to say. I don't know who I am. I don't know what my identity is. And she said, then speak it. Just speak that. That you don't have it all figured out. And I am here today, we are equals. We are all in this beautiful human journey, learning who we are, and consistently redefining this identity that we carry with us through our lives. 19 years ago this month, I had my 13th birthday. I entered the beautiful journey of teenagehood and had all of the blossom of possibility. I was a woman now. And I was the oldest woman in my home at this time. The summer before this, I had had five sisters all married in arranged marriages. You see, I was born in the FLDS Church, which is short for Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I was born right here in Salt Lake City, and we were a part of the community that was here up in Little Cottonwood Canyon. I was my mother's 11th child out of 14, and my father's 19th out of 24. So I was a little on the younger age, so I got to watch as many of my siblings went through this journey of what it meant to be a member of our religion. Going to school at the religious school up in Alta Academy, just right up there for many years, I became very involved with Warren Jeffs. At the time, the FLDS leader was Rulon Jeffs, and his son, Warren, was in charge of the school there. And for many years, he cultivated the youth. He taught them. He decided what kind of curriculum we would have, what kind of culturing that we would receive every single day. At that point in my life, at 13, my identity was shaped by those around me. My religion, my belief, the Book of Mormon that I reverently held every single day, the classes that I would go into where I was taught what it meant to be a woman within my community, and this vision of I would have one identity and one identity only, and I would be a mother in Zion, and my role would be to have children to populate my husband's kingdom. These were all crafted for me, and I couldn't even imagine a world outside of it. I remember many times growing up in this large home in Sugar House. You know, we lived a secular lifestyle. We didn't go out. We were our best friends. But I had my grandmother on my dad's side. Because, you see, my dad was a convert. He had began to explore the FLDS teachings in an effort to disprove the practice of polygamy. And ultimately, he found his heart and his testimony within the belief system of the FLDS. See, the FLDS have this idea that they follow the works of Joseph Smith as they originally were. Now, whether that's completely off or not, that was my core belief. It was something that burned inside of me desperately, and I wanted nothing more than to have the opportunity to meet Joseph Smith in the afterlife. I breathed it. I ate it. I listened to tape after tape after tape of Warren Jeff's voice as he drilled in these concepts that would ride with me for many years of my life. There came a moment where I became very aware of the outside world. I remember we were up at Bear Lake, and it was one of the few times that we had had the opportunity to be close to water. There was this underlying belief that somehow the devil existed in the water, and so it was very dangerous for us to swim in it and play in it, and we just didn't really do that. But for whatever reason, it was okay this time, and it was because the prophet, Warren and Rulin, had made it all right for that one day. And I was there playing, and I have a full-length prairie dress. My hair is wild and not perfectly combed like it normally is. And I'm looking over away from us about, maybe a football field. And I see this beautiful family. The mother is open and loving and kind, and the children are playing, and they're in bathing suits. And the father is there hugging and spending time playing with his children in the water. And I remember realizing that my father was absent. He wasn't there. I remember thinking, for the first time, something's not quite right. They are not evil. There is no way that beauty and that love that is coming from that family is truly evil. And it sparked a tiny little flame in me. And that little flame is what would bring me to where I am today. If I could go back to that little girl, probably 11 or 12, and tell her, thank you, I would have such gratitude for the opportunity that she allowed to plant that seed. The power of the church became very evident in my life very quickly. My sisters were married off in arranged marriages. Two of them married the prophet. One of them married the prophet's son. And the other was married in Canada in a community up there that was a satellite community of the FLDS. So I found myself the oldest daughter at home. And it became very aware that I got to take care of all the responsibilities of what that meant because I was preparing to be a wife. And I was going to be a damn good wife. In September, the unrest that had existed within our home erupted. There was a collision of lifestyles as my father and his first wife, who were married and had a whole family before they chose to enter into a polygamous lifestyle, they collided, and these core concepts, these identities that each woman had, could not coexist. My mother and myself and my father's third wife were all removed out of the home. There's this belief within the FLDS that women and children belong to the priesthood, and so therefore they don't belong to the man. And the power of the priesthood goes through that man and can be taken from him at the command of the prophet. In the middle of the night, we were loaded into a van and driven down to southern Utah to this little tiny town of Hilldale in Colorado City. Now, I had visited the town many times in my life. The highlights of us going down for conference, Harvest Festival, the opportunity to interact with cousins and aunts and uncles, people that I were just like me, people that dressed the same, talked the same, believed the same, people I could play with. I didn't have to look at them through a fence. But it was not a warm welcoming this time. My life was shattered. I couldn't even imagine what I was going into. You know, I didn't understand. I wasn't equipped with information. I was just told to put it on the shelf. The famous words that would forever haunt me for a long time. But I wanted answers. And me, this furious 13-year-old with all of those hormones raging through me, I wanted answers. And I didn't know how to express those. We would be moved into Hildell's bishop's home, Fred Jessup. And ever so slowly, we were adopted into the family. My mother was married to him, and we now became his children. And this belief began to swirl that somehow my very core identity, my very DNA, something that was mine, would now become that of Fred's. And I resisted. I remember getting into raging fights and battles with some of the other children in this home, and I refused. I wouldn't give up on my father. I believed that the teachings were true and that there was always hope. There was always an opportunity and always a chance. We had also left some older brothers of mine in Salt Lake. They had made the choice to not move down, and it was very painful for me to see my family torn into pieces with no real idea of where we would go or where we would end up. As my life began to adjust within this home and I started to find my grounding, I started to kind of reconfigure this identity. Who was I? I was no longer a Salt Laker, and I was no longer a wall. I was no longer this or that. I was something else. And once again, these concepts were being fed to me, force-fed to me, and expected that I would swallow them whole with no question. Fred Jessup, he was an older man, and he was known to be a benevolent caretaker of the community. But I saw a different side of him. I saw the way that he harshly commanded the children in the home. See, Fred couldn't have children of his own. And so all of these children that were in his home were people like me. We were from a broken family, a family that had lost their father and their priesthood head because they were no longer pure or good enough. And some of us bonded over it and some of us didn't. In this long line of many girls in the home, I was really far down. Traditionally, girls within the FLDS community kind of, most of the time, get married in a line of succession and age. And that would be my hope that I would hold on to for quite some time. It was just after spring had just started to light up southern Utah. And the desert was still, it was still new to me. It was something I was still becoming accustomed to. I was still getting used to the quiet and the crickets because it's so far away from anything else that you don't hear the sounds of the city or the freeway. I don't have the opportunity to look over the fence and see other kids and be tantalized by any other input than what was in my community. I was showing up to a family prayer, and we had just finished up, and Fred put his arm around me, and he said, "I have a place for you. Well, the prophet has a place for you." And I remember being so confused and not quite sure what was happening, and I was like, "Are you sure?" What I didn't realize is he was very sure. He was dead sure. And I would find that out over the next week. And over the next week, that little spark that started when I was just a little teeny thing would fire up, would do what very few women in my community did, and would choose to go against the grain and say no and ask the questions. Why? Why now? Can I get married in 2 years? Can I marry somebody else? Please, anyone, listen to me. And I became that little child on an island screaming at the top of my lungs for help and realizing that everyone in my community was helpless. No one, not even my very own mother, could stop it. After lots of effort on my part to bring a stop to this impending marriage, I ended up finding myself at the very feet of our prophet. And that, in my mind at that time, was being at the feet of God. And I believed, I had that burning belief that he was there to hear me and listen, and that he cared about me because I cared about him, and I was trying to be a good girl. And I tearfully pled my case to Roland Jeffs. Now, he had had multiple strokes at this point, and he was incredibly infirm. over the last couple of years, we had seen less and less of him and more of Warren, his son. This was just after year 2000, and there was this flurry to all gather into southern Utah, into Hilldale and Colorado City, because the end of days was coming, and we all had to be together to be lifted up. Well, the year 2000 came and went, and we were in 2001, and we still weren't lifted up. But it was coming. The Lord was giving us more time, and there was this impending fear, this realization that I was probably never going to be good enough. And especially now that I was questioning. So here I am, sitting there, tears streaming down my face. I'm 14 years old. How many of you have a 14-year-old child at home? Can you imagine handing them a decision like this? Demanding that they take the next step? I can't, and I have a 13-year-old. After I tearfully pled my case, Ruin looked down at me. He was eating lunch. I didn't even get his full attention. I got part of it. And he put his hands on mine and he said, "Follow your heart, Sweeney, just follow your heart." I think that's the one time in my life the divine inspiration has come through that man. Because what I wouldn't know in that moment is I would follow my heart. I would go on to more than follow my heart. I would define what that meant for me. I was relieved. I was so relieved. It was like the weight of the world went off my shoulders and I could breathe again. And I was saved. I wanted to be married in the future. I didn't want to be a single angel in heaven. I wanted to be married in the future, just not right now. Not right now. And I get up and all of a sudden my tears are gone and there's a smile on my face. And it's like the sun came out in this beautiful desert. And I'm walking down the hallway and Warren turns to me and says, "What will you do?" And I joyfully, "Well, I'm going to follow my heart, and my heart is telling me that I don't need to be married right now." And he stopped abruptly and put me in my place. "Your heart is in the wrong place, and if you want a place in this community, you will move forward." They're not exact words, but that was definitely the message that I heard, with all the fear and all the intimidation and all the weight of what it actually meant. I remember going home in a daze, not even sure I was living my own life. It was like a dream, and I couldn't pinch myself awake. I walked into the home defeated, completely and utterly defeated. I remember walking into my mother's room, and she's all playing the part of the happy mother. She's excited to finish my wedding dress, and I had been putting it off and putting it off. And here we had just got the message that we were being married in the morning, so we needed to be ready. And I sat in this daze as this flurry continued around me, not sure what was going on and feeling like I must be what it feels like to die. As slowly that energy, that life force just evaporated. I sat there as my mother sewed this beautiful wedding dress, desperately tried to give me everything that she wanted for me. This beautiful dress with appliques and everything that a good priesthood girl would have wanted. But I didn't. It was the dress of death for me. We would be driven into a new state to be married because I was marrying at such a young age, but I was also being forced to marry my first cousin. And that was highly illegal in the state of Utah at the time. We were driven in secret. We couldn't be dressed in our clothes. And I was asked to ride in the car with my to-be husband. This is where it hit me, the realization that I was going to live a lifetime with this man. Now, I had grown up with this man, and there was always something that just scared me about him, rubbed me wrong. He would tease me mercilessly as we were growing up, the few times I'd see him. And I just couldn't even stand to be around him. And this idea of being married to him, but not just that, but belonging to him for eternity, was too much. And as we got closer to this destination, it felt like we were driving for months. That little spark began to burn. Smolder, but it was there, and I could feel it. I remember standing in this hotel room, this dingy hotel room, standing there, and it's almost like sometimes I can step right back into that moment. But the best part about doing it now is I can step into it as the woman I am today. I don't have to be that little girl. I don't have to be that little girl standing in white with tears running down her face so heavily that the entire front of her dress is soaked. I'm not that little girl that has to have her mother stand up next to her to get her to say, I do. That has to have the pressure of those that she loves to sign her death warrant. I'm not her. The years that would follow were wrought with all kinds of lessons. And I choose to call them lessons because I am not a victim. I hear the word rape and I understand the weight of that, what that really means, how that scars you on the inside. And you think, yeah, it'll never go away. And years of it, years of emotional and physical abuse, years of not knowing who I was and being wrestled from place to place and told that I was a horrible wife, a horrible woman, having miscarriages and never feeling like I was good enough to even be a mother. I mean, all before the age of 17. There came a point in this journey where I realized that it was a matter of life and death. Slowly, that smoldering force was diminishing. I was believing the identity that everybody was handing to me. I was believing that I was worthless. I was believing that I would never go to heaven. I was believing that I would never be happy. I would never successfully carry a child. And I would end up a single angel in heaven. So why not just end it now? Why continue this hell? There's got to be no other hell worse than the one I was in. But that beautiful humanness in all of us, that human spirit that connects every single one of us, would not give up. And I began to question and think. I began to wonder about my siblings that had left the FLDS before. Were they alive? Were they okay? Had they been burned at the stake? Had they been struck down with lightning? And to realize that they weren't. They were out there creating their own life. A little glimmer of hope began to burn inside of me and wondering, what if? What if? I believe that often we call the people to us in the right moment at the right time for the right reasons. And I had just happened to meet a gentleman who was also from my community. We had met on one of the worst nights of my life. I was in the throes of a miscarriage, and things had gotten so bad that my safety was getting in my vehicle, driving out onto the Arizona Strip, and finding my calm with the coyotes. It was easier to do that. It was more comforting and safer to go out there in a vehicle than it was to go home. And I happened to have a flat tire. It was a cold November night, and the snow was starting to fall. And normally snow is magic. I can smell the snow as it comes, and I have no greater joy than to sit in that first snowstorm of the year. And as it swallowed us in this flurry of white, these lights drove up to me, and I panicked. Because I was a married woman. I should not be out at night by myself. I can't tell you the countless times that I would be gathered up by the police and dragged home. The very people that were supposed to be protecting me, that I could have gone to and said, I need help, they were the ones bringing me back. They were the ones reprimanding me and making sure that those in charge of me knew where I was. Realize it wasn't. It wasn't the police. And this gentleman hopped out and asked me if I needed help. That encounter would lead me to find the courage and the strength to make my next move. Through friendship and connection, I fell in love with this man. And I realized that there was hope in the world. I wasn't hopeless. Somebody could put up with me. And then the priest had found out. And I was pulled into my last meeting, face to face with Warren, as an FLDS member under his control. At this point in time, he was in hiding. He was redeeming Zion. He was on very secret missions, and nobody really knew, and there was all kinds of secrecy and tension within our community. The prophet, Roland Jeffs, had passed away, and that was painful for the community. He was never supposed to pass away. He was going to be redeeming us in Zion, and he was going to take us to the afterlife, and he was going to live forever, and he didn't. Ever so slowly, Warren took that position. I can't tell you how many times I speak for my father. His light and his spirit shines through me. And then he began to bury his father's wives, one at a time, starting with my aunt, Aura. Something he swore he would never do. He wasn't going to marry any of father's wives because father was going to be renewed and he was going to come back. That was what we were told. I remember walking in knowing I could feel it. I could feel it coming, and I couldn't tell if I was afraid or if I was excited. I was just done. By this point, I'd been married for 3 years. I was almost 18, and I had asked so many times to be released from this marriage, I couldn't even count anymore. I can't tell you how many times I was dragged in front of Fred Jessup or Warren Jeffs and reprimanded and commanded to give myself mind, body, and soul. If I would just surrender and give myself over to my husband, everything would be okay. But it wasn't okay. Throughout this meeting, this teleconference that Warren's there, he also had one of his other new bishops, because Fred Jessup had disappeared and gone into hiding, and he proceeded to finally grant me my release. Finally. But not just that, remind me that I was condemned to hell. I remember the moment where my brain just cracked and I was like, realized something was really wrong. Warren turned his conversation to Alan, my cousin, who for 3 years, 3 full years, had tortured me. And said, "Job well done." And my brain was like exploded. It was that moment when you see your vision go red and you can't really be in control of this response you have. And I couldn't even comprehend how God could ever turn to a man like that and say, "Job well done." And it was like fury and anger and sadness and panic. All of it rose up in me. And I began to just cry and lose it because I couldn't even imagine. And I was then told that I'd be a single angel and I would be given to be under the care of my father, who he wasn't even good enough to have a family. So what does that make me to be given back to him? But that night would be the beginning, one of the greatest nights of my life, because for the first time, I would choose me. And I would begin to flex this muscle as I consistently chose me. Something that I'd never been told to do. Something that wasn't even a part of my identity. And I ran away. I left a note, gathered a few things I had, called the gentleman that I knew had my back, and said, "Let's go." I remember driving away and watching the lights and thinking, "What have I done?" It was like jumping through the Grand Canyon, but it's full of fog and mud, and you have no idea what's on the other side. We would begin this incredible journey of acclimating into society. And it was like being a refugee walking into New York. People spoke different. Social cues were different. Expectations were different. Learning how to go grocery shopping, get a job, have a bank account. What is school? An education, I don't even know what that is. You know, all these things that we take for granted today, these were new. These were hard. These were obstacles that felt like impassable. But in time, we did it. I realized just how strong I was and just how okay I was the day my son was born. I remember holding this beautiful blonde baby boy, and I was a mother. I was a mother after all these years and all of this heartbreak and all of this shame that I held. I was a mother. And I looked at this beautiful baby boy and I thought, no one is ever going to hurt him. And I began to realize that's how my mother should have felt. That's how my father should have felt. That's how all of them should have felt, that nobody should ever hurt this baby or me. And I began to remember that I had two younger sisters, and we were the three musketeers. We did everything together. They're quite a bit younger than these, so they were very fond in my heart. And the choice to leave them behind was one of the hardest things I ever did. But they always were there with me. Even though I pretended like nothing was wrong, even though I put everything under the surface and I wanted to forget my past life, I didn't want to be Elisa. I didn't want to be that because that was just too much. That was too hard. And ever so slowly, I realized that nobody was there to advocate for them. As I watched my son grow and I watched all these beautiful landmarks that babies experience, they discover and they find little tiny shreds of their identity as they go along. Nobody was there to protect my younger sisters. And through miraculous events, the right people came at the right time. And we began a journey of freedom. We began a journey of accountability. And we began a journey of setting a new standard. I love seeing Roger here today because he's one of my favorite people in the world. Because Roger became that light in a very dark world. He became my attorney, and he brought a sense of safety and confidence that I didn't possess in myself. This realization that I could do this, that I could go to the police, I could go to Washington County, and I could tell my story. I didn't really know what that story was because it was just my story, and I didn't know what was right or wrong or how bad it really was. And through Roger's guidance and assistance, he helped me find the right people, the people that could honor what this story actually meant. I sat there next to an investigator, and I put it all out on the table. For once in my life, the first time I spoke my truth. All of it. Well, most of it. As much as would come to me at that time. And I cried it out, and I vomited it out, and I came out in all ways and left it all out on the table. And I remember the first time I realized that it was serious. This woman, her tears were coming down her face, and she said, "What happened to you was wrong." The first time anyone had validated that I was a person, and I had been wronged. We would go on to have quite the ride as we, I say we because it was many of us, and I'm sure many of you were there too in spirit. In a united front, we took on a monster. In November, actually, I'll never forget the day. I was actually expecting my second child. I knew it was a little baby girl, and I was so excited. And it was August 28th, and we were in this little tiny hotel room because we were in protection. The people around us, this team of amazing people, had realized that I was vulnerable. And because I was willing to speak my truth, because I was willing to take on this monster and this hydra that had become so much bigger than any one person could take on, they knew that I needed protection. And it was early in the morning, and the phone starts ringing. And my little babies are starting to rustle and wake up, and I pick up the phone. And it's Brock Belknap, Washington County prosecutor, my dear friend at this point. Dear, dear friend. And he said, "He's been caught." And once again, my world tilted, and I saw red, because I realized this was serious. Warren had been caught. After being on America's Most Wanted list, he'd been caught. He'd been caught in a random traffic stop, and it was all over the news, and things picked up from there. When he was found guilty, after a long trial, after speaking my truth once again on an international stage, because it was a highly publicized trial, after this whirlwind of witnesses and defense attorneys and moments of empowerment, moments of fear and choosing to face it. I remember this moment, and I will always remember this moment because it's what I call my birthplace of freedom. And I was getting ready to go onto the stand for the first time, and I was so nervous. My very own child in my belly was in a circus. She was turning circles, and together it was just us. But I knew that I had to go face Warren. I'd spoken my truth, but I hadn't faced him yet. I remember looking up, sitting at that witness stand, and looking up and locking eyes with him. And it was like the world stopped. You could hear, in my world, you could hear a pin drop. The air went out of my lungs. I knew I had a choice. In that moment, I had a choice. And I stared that man down because he no longer had influence over me. He no longer got to decide my identity. He no longer got to decide my destiny, my happiness, my afterlife, my salvation. And we stared, and we stared, and my heart
started to slow down, and my beautiful daughter started to calm. And finally, he shook his head, and he dropped his eyes. And that was victory. Not victory because I had overcome him. Victory for me, because I had chosen me. I'd chosen me and my baby daughter and my younger sisters and all of those people that I loved. Warren would be found guilty of accomplice to rape and would be sentenced for a very long time in prison. And this realization that we had accomplished something, that we had won, we had made progress. Because now we could begin the journey, the beautiful, incredible journey of liberating and freeing not just myself, but lots of other people. Over the coming years, I would have the opportunity to touch many lives. And I consider that a gift. It was overwhelming. It was intimidating. I wrote a book and went on a whirlwind book tour and began to speak my truths to a larger audience. Began to educate the world of what was actually happening within our community. One of the most shocking things that I had experienced during Warren's trial was this realization that the world didn't really know what was happening. They had a really hard time believing and configuring this reality in their brains. And it became time to speak again. Now, I'm glad it doesn't show today because I'm calm, but I have horrible stage fright. Horrible stage fright. I have a very difficult time feeling confident enough to look you in the eye and feel like I have something to say. And to take that on and to choose to do that on such a big stage was something bigger than I could have imagined. And it would begin to create another identity within me. It was at this point in time in my journey when I started to really own who I was. I started to realize that I did have purpose, that I did have value, that I was a mother and I was a survivor and I was an author and I was all these other things, all these things and lots of pieces that society was still giving me. What did it mean to be a victim? I didn't like the word. It crawled up my back like a spider or something else. Not a spider. Spiders are great. But I didn't like this. I didn't like this tag, this victim. I didn't even know what it meant, really. I just know I didn't like it. And then I transitioned into, oh, I'm a survivor. I'm a survivor. I know what this means. What does it mean? What does it mean? What does it mean? Who am I? What am I? What do I believe in? Where am I going? Am I a good mother? Am I a good person? On and on and on and on. And I began to realize how important it was to have a relationship with myself. As society was kind of coming down on me and all these changes were happening and the pressure of being on Oprah, the pressure of having a book, the pressure of having readers from all over the world that loved the message that I had and would write to me and tell me how beautiful it was to know there was someone they could connect with. You know, I began to have pieces of myself all over the world connected with these people that I had empathy and compassion for. Such a beautiful gift and a beautiful responsibility. Because now we really did have to change it. I began to be very heavily involved in these relief efforts to help people like myself who were leaving the FLDS. With Warren being in prison and time starting to pass, it was opening up an opportunity for people to begin to make choices for themselves. Questions were swirling. People's spirit, their fire that was in them, was starting to light and warm them and burn all of the crap away. And I got that beautiful experience of helping so many people as they would come into my home on an overnight, or I would get to sit with them on their first night out of the FLDS, and they're shaking with fear. And I realized that we're exactly the same because they were just as afraid as I was when I left. But that I got to remind them that there is life after leaving. There is life after choosing out. There is life, and you get to live it. That was such an incredible opportunity to be a part of that for so many years. And I watched my children grow, and I started to create other parts of this identity that I held inside. You know, started a business that failed. Was a mother? Was I going to school? Was I a good mother? Was I a mediocre mother? Was I a sister? And ever so slowly, my family started to come back into my life, and I was like a magnet. I just wanted to hold on to them because hadn't had them for so long. But always there, wondering where my mother was, wondering where my sisters were. You see, right after I left, they disappeared, poofed. We called them poofers. They went to Zion or some magical place we didn't know, but deep down inside, I always wondered and worried. Right around the same time my book was published, the Texas raid was happening on the community of the FLDS down in Texas. And it was, I don't know how many of you are familiar with it, but it was very intense. It was very disruptive to a lot of people. And mistakes were made on all parts. Children were caught in the middle. And Texas did the very best they could to prosecute and hold accountability for crimes that were committed against children, just like me, and just like your children at home. Through that process, I had the opportunity to work with law enforcement and be a bridge between these two worlds, because I did understand that they were two separate worlds. The verbiage was different. Belief systems were different. How do you identify with them? How do you understand what they're saying? And here they're trying to investigate these crimes that were alleged. And 400 children were caught in the middle of it. And I found myself in this place of desperation. My heart broke. I remember driving onto the Texas compound and seeing these children and women loaded into buses and just thinking, there has to be a better way. There has to be a better way. We cannot keep doing this for years to come. Go after one community after another and rip it out of them, because we didn't have that right to rip it out of them. We had the opportunity to give them a walker, to show them there's a way that they could choose it. Why that was such important to me is that it started to help me understand that we had to approach this from a different angle. We couldn't go at it just from the legal system. We couldn't go at it just from holding the men accountable, or how are we going to stop child brides? How are we going to stop people from being forced to marry? How are we going to stop children from being currency within this religion? And over time, and age and wisdom, and lots of learning lessons in my life, collapses, complete and total falling on my face and realizing that I was very, very human, as much as I wanted to be superhuman and I wanted to be Superman. Because out there somewhere, my sisters were still there. They were still there, and they still deserved to be loved. They still deserved to have opportunity. It started to plant a seed in my brain that, you know, we have these foundations holding out help, Voices of Dignity, Diversity Foundation, these people that were starting to come together to coagulate, to create these catch systems, these nets, to find the most effective way to help people choose out of the FLDS or similar cult-like communities. And it started to nagle at my brain, why are we just picking up the pieces? What is it going to take to actually solve the problem? To actually hit it at its heart and really change it? You know, at this point, I had dedicated 10 years of my life in the court system, whether that was through prosecuting Warren Jeffs or creating a new accountability within the justice system for how you treat victims like myself. I had filed two lawsuits. I settled one and was successful in another. And these were landmark events within our state, within our society, because we are beginning to set a better standard to accept that we need to reach for more. 2 years ago, it became possible for me to move home. Now, the idea of moving back to Hilldale instantaneously was too much. It was too hot. It was too overwhelming. It brought me almost to tears. I couldn't even imagine it. But it just kept eating away at me. Like, there's got to be a better way. There's got to be a better way. What I didn't know is there was a part of me that knew that I deserved to reclaim what was lost there. It deserved to go back and be more than what I had left as. And I jumped in head first, feet first, belly first, all the way. And I chose to move. Sold my home in Salt Lake and went on a trip in South America and found parts of myself. Traveling the world helped me realize that there was such a huge world and people from all walks of life with all kinds of journeys, all kinds of pain, all kinds of fear, all kinds of triumph, all kinds of encouragement. And I came home, and in August of 2016, I rooted myself in Hilldale, Utah. And we began to redefine a community. I say we because there are so many beautiful people that have been a part of this incredible 2 years. I see some of your faces in here, and I hold such gratitude for the roles that you have played in this beautiful ride. Because if you drive down to Hilldale today, you're going to find people on the street. You're going to find kids in school. You're going to find restaurants open. And you're going to find homes being built, fences coming down. You're going to find a community that is choosing to redefine, reclaim, and be resilient. Through this journey, I've really come to appreciate some core parts of who I am. I'm tenacious. I am courageous. And don't get in front of me because I'll probably just grab your arm and make you walk right there with me. I'm not going to bulldoze you, but we're going to figure out how to get you enrolled in this. Just ask Roger. But through this incredible journey that I've had, I've come to realize the importance of my identity and what that really means for me. You know, because of this incredible journey that has been gifted to me and the ability to have resilience in times of collapse, the ability to own all of it, the good, the bad, the ugly, the painful, the scary, the joyful, has made me who I am today. And I would just like to share just a few things that, you know, have helped me get along this way. Oh, we're running out of time, so I'll make them really quick here. Oh, okay. I've come to understand that as human beings, we are quick to identify ourselves using our circumstances, how others perceive us, how the world perceived Elisa while I was creating that inside of me. Our behaviors, these moments of fear and these moments of panic, I was creating an identity around those. And our position in life, I was still that victim, even though I didn't want to admit it. I was still wearing it like a cloak, and it followed me and dragged on the ground, and I would hide it and do the very best I could to transcend it or be better than it, bigger than it, more than it, and it was always still there. For some reason, this identity, we clothe ourselves in it, and the sad thing is all of that stuff is not really who we are, none of it, because that's for us to figure out. And through this process, I've realized that by listening to all of those voices, by listening to my culture, my past religion, all of these things, by hearing those tapes playing in my head, by allowing them to play in my head, I was limiting my growth. And I was becoming very lost and being stripped of what really was mine. It brought me to this place in my journey where I began to understand what it meant to listen to our own narrative. How do I define myself? I began to write it down everywhere. I had whiteboards in my bedroom, and I would just, the days that I couldn't sleep, or it was just too much, or the anxiety was about to collapse my chest, I would write, and I would scribble all over these whiteboards, and I would pour my heart out, and I would draw, or whatever it may be. And I began to find that, those little shreds of who I was. Words that kept coming up. Compassion, love. To be loved. I had this need to be loved. I didn't really know what it meant, but I needed to feel it. Along this journey, I'd also been divorced. This wonderful man who had gifted me with two beautiful children had moved on in his life. And we had become great friends. We were business owners and friends. But I was on this journey. I was on my own. It was me on my own tub bottom, as scary and as terrifying as it might be and as beautiful as that journey was. I got to spend many years just me and holding myself in that space. I began to read and discover and seek information. I began to be hungry like a sponge, like somebody had to have this figured out. Somewhere in this world, somebody had it figured out, and I was going to find them. And I did, and I started to discover beautiful people, Brené Brown, Maya Angelou, one of my favorite quotes of her, I will always carry it dear to my heart. You may not control all the events that happen to you, but you can decide not to be reduced by them. I didn't have to be the victim. I didn't have to be reduced to that tag or that piece of identity. I didn't have to. I just had to figure out how to be Elisa. So I'm 30, over 30 now. Beautiful age to be, all the 30-year-olds. Love it, embrace it, be it. I'm so excited for 40 because I swear it gets better. It really does. But in these 30-plus years that I've been around, I've come to these things of identity and what it means for me to have an empowered identity. And I call them the four R's of identity. Redefine, reclaim, and resilience. And what those mean to me, I'll just take a few minutes to give you what those actually mean to me, because redefine is the most powerful. Because I get to choose. I get to question everything, every day. I get to ask myself, do I want this? Is this mine? Was this given to me? Was this given from generation to generation to generation? Was this a part of a past religion? Is this spirituality? Is this dogma? Is this BS? And I began to sort through these puzzle pieces. There was a point in my life where I was like a vase that just shattered into a million pieces. And through this process of redefining, I began to pick them up one piece at a time. And I don't know if you've ever seen it, but there's this beautiful, exquisite Japanese art in which they take shattered ceramics or vases or plates or bowls, and they piece them together with gold. And so the end project is this beautiful piece of art that's veined with brilliant gold that shines through all of that porcelain. And I bonded to that and realized that I could be more than I was, because I could be beautiful. I would be like that gorgeous Japanese vase, and the cracks would be just as beautiful as the pieces. It was heartwarming to know that I was capable of this, but then I arrived at this place of gut-wrenching truth. I had labeled myself a survivor because I was unwilling to acknowledge the pain that I had carried with me. I defined myself by my experiences and so created a life that where every action was driven by my past. And I didn't deserve that. I just didn't know it. I began to ask the right questions. And that's what is the key to redefining, is the right questions. With a willingness to be open to the answers. And most of the time, they weren't the answers that I actually wanted. But they were the ones that resonated as true for me. Is this mine? Did I create this? If I did create it, do I still want it? Because I can let it go. And I began this beautiful journey, anguishing journey of letting go and redefining and choosing which pieces of this vase I actually wanted. And then I came to this beautiful place of acknowledgement. See, redefining is scary. It strips us down. It makes us vulnerable to the most dangerous person in our life, and that's ourselves. And that gorgeous, incredible journey is our gift of claiming who we really are. I ask you that throughout your life, ask yourself, who am I? And be grateful to have the opportunity to define that. You know, I think it's grand that I have the opportunity to talk to you today, because I myself am going through a beautiful redefining of who I am. Once again, I am transcending into a new, found, beautiful identity that is mine. And once in continuing to strip away the dogma, all of these other pieces that other people gave me that I really didn't want, that I don't want, and I will let go. Which brings me to reclaiming. Now, reclaiming is important because we were born perfect and beautiful. You can't tell me that there is a single baby on this earth that you can't look at and just know it is the most beautiful creature in that moment. But somehow along this journey of life, someone told us that it wasn't good, that we weren't good enough, that those pieces of us needed to go away. And those parts of us that are truly who we are, they are just waiting for us to own them. They're still there. They're like dragging along behind us, They're still there and waiting for you to be reclaimed. Our creativity, our joy, our humor. So many of us have allowed society to beat the humor right out of us, and it's there. My kids and I have started this new movement, and you are welcome to join us, and we call ourselves the Kidness Clan, bringing out the kid in all of us. That's a thing. Just you wait. Just you watch. Take back what was lost. Take it back. And even to this day, I am taking it back, and I'm choosing to own it and make it mine and make it beautiful. And that's what makes us equals, exactly the same, is we're in this together, this beautiful human journey. And I'm so excited to have journey mates, because it's not very fun to be alone. And I choose to experience it with you. Which brings me to resilience. Now, I know this is a buzzword and we hear it in everything. Resilience in business, resilience your brain, resilience in emotional resilience, all these different things. But what does resilience actually mean? And it's a great word and it's beautiful and it's powerful. But it actually just means to overcome and grow past our past. To be more than, to expand past it. Resilience is actually not a trait that people either have or don't have. It involves behaviors. It involves thoughts. It involves actions. And these things can be learned and developed over time. And I learned how to claim my resilience. I learned how to own it. Resilience does not eliminate the stress or ease life's difficulties, I've come to realize. You'd think that I would have this all figured out, but I don't. Instead, it gives people the strength to tackle the problems head on, to overcome with adversity and grow past them. Resilience isn't about overcoming the day-to-day burdens or the hassles. It's about thriving, truly thriving, about becoming stronger, healthier, more flexible. Resilience is about flexibility, the ability to flex through these moments of pain and these moments of struggle and redefining. And it promotes compassion. And that is our greatest gift, is compassion. Now, through this process of redefining, I'm learning it again right now. There's these monsters, and I've come to understand them well. I know them, I see them, and I call them the three growth monsters. They're shame, blame, and comparison. And man, these guys are good. They're so good. Often they're weaved so deep within us that we can't even identify the difference between who they are and we are. The dogma that was given to us through generations and generations of not enough, not enough, fears, lack, pain, sorrow. Those are all the traits of these three monsters. Now, shame is insidious. It disguises itself as a desire to be a better person. I've come to see that this drive to be more than I was wasn't about compassion, wasn't about love, it was shame. It robs us of the commitment to move on. Meanwhile, it burrows deep in our soul and makes a home where until the day you break it open and shine the light on it, it resides. My favorite person in the world, Brené Brown, has a quote that says, "Shame corrodes the very part that believes we are capable of change." I will not be corroded anymore. Now I come to blame. Now, blame is the most interesting one because it so easily disguises itself. But one of my favorite blame researchers, actually, is Carl Asko. He has a PhD. He actually has a book that's great if you ever want to read it. But the blame is the most toxic emotional BS out there. It is. It's toxic. There's nothing about it that brings anything into our life that we really want to have. It's also one of the biggest thieves in life. For me, I blamed for a very long time. I blamed Warren Jeffs. I blamed my parents. I blamed Alan Steed, the man who I'd been married to. I blamed all of these people. I blamed the society. Why would they let that happen to me? And this blame was this giant backpack that over time I kept adding rocks to, finding more people to blame, but biggest of all, blaming myself. How could you let that happen to you? How could you be so stupid? How could you be so dumb? Why are you so ugly? You know, this blame, this terrible blame game. The sad part about blame is it takes without honor, and it robs us of the possibility of growth. Most of all, it robs us and depletes all joy, completely gone. You cannot experience blame and joy at the same time. You can't blame and truly smile at the same time. And our last monster, one of the hardest ones, and the one that is truly the most deceiving, is comparison. You see, comparison is actually just judgment in disguise, and it is dressed up beautifully. It sits there and makes us think that somehow if we compare ourselves to our sister or the beautiful woman across the street, that somehow we're going to be better like them, that we're going to all of a sudden be skinny and all of a sudden have all the money in the world. And, you know, this comparison game that just eats our brains out. See, the sad reality is that comparison destroys our ability to create or to change. It eats away at our motivation for dinner, really. And the danger of comparing ourselves to others is that our comparisons are never fair. Each one of us is unique, and we are individuals with characteristics and life events that are so beautifully unique to us. So, I have learned how to go monster stomping. That's what we call it in my house. Let's go monster stomping. Because we work to identify these three monsters in our life because we will grow past them. We will defeat them. So I've come up with my own perfect formula that works for me on how to go monster stomping. My first one is speak your truths. This is so incredibly important. It is that bullet straight to the heart of all of those monsters. Speak from the heart. Own it. Own it. You don't need handouts. You don't need a PowerPoint. You just own it. You own all of it, the good, the bad, the ugly, the beautiful, the scary, the magnanimous. Admitting your truth to yourself can be one of the hardest things you'll ever do. And don't do what I did, because it doesn't have to be dramatic. It's just powerful. Your truth-telling is truly a guarantee to cause change, even if it's only in you. So let's tell those truths together, because I want to change, and I know you do too. Just looking at our time here. And lastly, another one of my favorite quotes, I actually have it written on my mirror all the time. Brené Brown, once again, I highly suggest her work, and someday I will get to meet this beautiful woman. But she says, shame cannot survive being spoken. It cannot tolerate words being wrapped around it. So if you want to defeat that shame monster, speak your truths. Next, compassion. This word that kept coming up for me over and over in my life, compassion, compassion. What does that mean? How do I use it? What I didn't realize is that compassion starts with me. I had to practice compassion for me. We are born kind. We are born compassionate. We are born with truth. And over time, that's robbed from us by life experience, and we hand it over without realizing that's what we're doing. Most importantly, having compassion for yourself means that you're honoring and accepting the humanness in all of us. So if you have a loved one and you're compassionate to your loved one, you owe it to yourself to be just as compassionate to you. That's been my hardest monster, my hardest habit to adopt. Because once again, all those pieces of identity that kept singing in my head, playing over and over, didn't think I was worthy of compassion. Didn't think that I deserved it. Which is where it brought me to brave, to be brave. Because I believe that bravery is love. I hear I get teared up just talking about bravery. I'm always telling myself, be brave, be brave. Fear always leads to regret, while bravery leads to knowing. To be brave, you must be willing to risk the possibility of a terrifying end. But to be brave is to be alive and to live in such a way that the world knows that you are afraid. I am afraid to be up here. but you love more than you fear. And lastly, the most subtle and the most powerful tool against those shame monsters is to smile. Power is given to things that can impact, that can create influence, and change things in a profound way. And a smile, it has that kind of power. You can't smile and be angry at the same time. You can't smile and hold shame at the same time. Truly smile. A smile can take one of the biggest, most major swipes at those monsters. So I invite you, when those monsters are raging, and you're monster stomping, and you're knee deep, and you've lost your tools, and you don't know where they are, just smile. Just breathe and smile. Smiling brings joy. It relieves our stress. It calms the anxiety. And negativity has no place where a real smile exists. So I'd like to open the floor up for a few questions. I'm not 100% sure how much time we have. It's 3:06. Oh, perfect. You guys get to continue to hear me. But I would like to open it up for a few minutes. So please, I would love to answer any questions you may have.
Thanks for sharing your story. It really is amazing, and it's been a treat to be here for me. I used to work with child victims, and so it's nice to hear your story. But I have a question. I know for a time Warren still was capable of exerting influence. Have you ever been worried about retribution? Have you ever had any experience with that or fear of that?
That's a good one. Yes. I think that was always a possibility of retribution. I was very lucky to have people in my world that kind of saw that coming and the possibility of it and took major steps to protect us. And over time, I've come to realize that retribution is only as powerful as I give credence to it. It's only as threatening to me as I allow it to be. And the act of me moving back into Hildel was the ultimate act of facing that retribution dead on. Because I didn't want to run from it anymore. If someone wanted to hurt me, I wanted to look them in the eye, and I wanted to hug them and smile at them and hold them close, because I knew that they were experiencing fear and pain. They really didn't want to hurt me. They just didn't know how to deal with all of the pain they were experiencing. So I don't know if that's the perfect answer, but...
As a survivor, as you call yourself, for someone who's looking to help a future or a survivor themselves, what would you tell us if we're a good friend or if we're just an acquaintance? What was the best thing someone could do on my stance to help you or not do?
Great question. Thank you very much for speaking that. So I actually have this really fun thing. In this process of redefining me and my identity, and I'm really big into words. I love reading. I love words. I love new words and great words. I create words all the time. And I have a new word for you. It's called surthriving. And it doesn't have anything to do with surviving. It means surrendering to thriving. And the reason that is so important is because through this process, I've realized that I was in my own way. I was my biggest enemy. And when I learned how recently to surrender to this experience that I was on, only then can I truly begin to thrive. So that's my word, surthriving, and it has nothing to do with survival. Because I don't want to survive. I want to thrive. And so your question is, what can we do to help? Empathy first. Empathy first, empathy first. And what is empathy? Empathy is not, oh, I still feel sorry for you. Empathy is not pity. Empathy says, I don't understand what you're going through, but I see you're hurting, and I am here for you. That's what empathy is. And empathy is, it's like a hug without a hug. And it's this connection that we can share with anyone. It can be someone on the street that just got in a car accident. It can be your very best friend who's overcoming one of the darkest moments of her life. And listen. Listen with no expectations. My dear, dearest friend is teaching me this lesson now, where it's this concept of listening with this honor and this joy and this appreciation. And it's something I'm just discovering. And I'm so grateful to have this opportunity to discover what it really does mean to listen, with no expectations, with no judgment, with no pity, with just listen. And those are the two things you can do that are so important. And lastly, truly lastly, be your own best advocate. Because trust me, some of the most important people in my life are people that were choosing to thrive, that were overcoming and being resilient. And I got to look at them and say, I want what they have. Well, how did they get there? Well, what can I do? So thrive yourself. Next question.
Thank you. That's an amazing ordeal that you described. My question is what has that experience done to your, your view of and relationship with God?
Yes, this question always comes up. And that's okay, because it's important to all of us. It's a piece of who we are. My relationship with God is actually not even a part of my identity anymore, because I realize that it is just mine to own. I don't hold it as an identity. What is my relationship with God? I do not believe in organized religion. I never will subscribe to one that allows someone to be better than me, because nobody is better than me. But I am highly spiritual. I believe that there is purpose, and I believe that I have many angels and assistants out there, because I am standing here today because of them. So that's not the perfect answer, because anybody's relationship with God is never perfect, and it has its own ebb and flow. There were days where I was very angry at God, and I swore I was an atheist. And the concept of God was just, made me so angry, because I wanted to blame him for everything that had happened. And I've since had the wonderful journey of being able to find a much more peaceful place within myself. Thank you, though, for asking the question and being willing to hear me.
So you mentioned the other side of it, where the law came and into Texas and started doing some things that were questionable, maybe unethical. What are your feelings on the now, as far as like President Trump deporting and separating families, children from their mothers and fathers?
Oh, that is the magic question for everyone. Really, that is, because I think we all have an attachment to this answer. And it's constantly changing with more information and my political views and my ideas of what's going on within our very country. I'm angry at where we're at, because I believe there is a better way. And I will not blame anyone, because I know the monster blame is. I won't blame Trump or ICE or any one person, because we're all contributing to this environment that we're seeing happen and play out. And the exciting thing about that is we actually can be the solution. And so that's my answer, really, is I am very motivated to find the solution on a micro scale. And that's what I'm doing in my community now, is I am finding the solutions in Hilldale and Colorado City now. We are electing our city councils for the first time, our first female mayor. We are putting in new parks. We are having 4th of July celebrations where anyone is welcome and open. We are creating support groups and systems for people, all kinds of opportunities for people to choose into this growth. And so that's kind of where I start. Sometimes when I look at the larger scale, I get really intimidated and really stressed out, because there's nothing I can do about it. But because of all of this, I'm a huge advocate for voting. And it's great, because in my town, when people see me and they're not a registered voter, they kind of walk the other direction. Because I don't even have to say anything, so it's great. No, we've created this wonderful movement called RISE, and it stands for Responsibility, Involvement, Strength, and Equality, because that's what we stand for in the community of Hilldale. And it's been beautiful, because we started with Utah, and we started with education, just helping people understand what it meant to have a voice and how to exercise it in a political arena and how to be involved in the conversations that were going to shape their future. And have wonderful voter drives, wonderful opportunities, and we were successful in Hilldale. We voted in 3 new city council members and a female mayor, and it has radically changed our community. And it's been the most pleasant, subtle, kind change that the community has ever seen. And so now we're focused on Arizona, and we're doing the same thing there. And it's just all about empowering and asking people to own their voice and be willing to formulate an opinion. Something that we weren't really bred to do. So I hope that answers your question. Next question.
I knew your father and Myrna before you were born.
Small world.
I remember him when he was the president of the junior class at Carbon High School.
Wow.
I remember him when he was a halfback on the BYU football team. I remember him before he knew Warren Jeffs and was a polygamist.
You got to see a part of him that we didn't get to see.
Yeah. I saw him on Dr. Phil when one of your sisters wouldn't come into the room to talk with him. And I just wondered, what is your relationship with them? He's a victim also, I think. Warren Jeffs took two of his wives and many of his children away. Mm-hmm. What do you think?
Once again, I hear the word victim, and that triggers me. And that's okay. Because, yes, my father was harmed by Warren Jeffs. And, yes, he had a very difficult journey, and it was unfair and it was unjust what happened to him. Like so many people of the FLDS, their true spiritual desires and their true belief systems were warped and manipulated and destroyed so many families and so many people. That's been the true travesty here, is the families, the fathers, the mothers, the children. It's not Warren Jeffs. It's what's happened to them. So what is my relationship with my father? It's building. It is. It's building. I've reconnected with him, and he's slowly made his journey into what he is defining as his identity and his reality. And we do connect, and he's doing well. He is. He's older, and so he's just doing really well. And I look forward to being able to make those reconnections in a positive way. It's taken time, and I know that a lot of my choices and decisions were difficult for people that were still in the FLDS. They received a lot of dogma and a lot of these ideas of who I was that weren't true and weren't real. And it takes time for people to redefine those, including my father. So.
You know, it's worth remembering what a remarkable person he is. He developed the opening.
He did.
For the space shuttle in his kitchen.
Yes, he did. He is a remarkable person, and I am very honored to have him as my father.
Hi.
Hi.
I have two questions for you in regards to your underage marriage and what you went through rolls over into the question of the Texas raid and what all the children went through.
Mm-hmm.
Don't you think that was a small price to pay for how much relief you've given to others and the children, you know, that hurt a lot for them to be taken away. But
yes,
there's so many people that have been relieved from that.
Yes. I agree completely. We're actually from the same community. So Grace Ann always helps me. Interestingly enough, I've really come to believe that we change for two reasons. One, we change because we choose to, or we change because the pain of staying the same is greater than the pain of changing. And the Texas raid was painful, but it was absolutely necessary. It broke open this dark, horrible, insidious, evil nest of yuck like nothing else could. And yes, it was a small price to pay. And there are children that are still paying it, but it gave us quantum leaps of progress. The evidence that came out of the Texas raid has liberated more people from the clutches of the FLDS and Warren Jeffs than any one thing. Isn't that amazing how just knowledge and power has been the freedom that everyone was looking for? So that alone makes it worth it.
I feel selfish because we get to have sleepovers and talk.
Yes, Lindsay and I. This is how this happened.
So first of all, thank you so much personally. And I have to also say this funny thing, which is I was complaining to her about all my like online haters, and then she was so sweet, and then I was like, oh yes, she actually had to go into hiding. Lindsay, buck up a little bit. So, but one of the most valuable things I found in my relationship with you is the politics in your community, in the FLDS community, and the LDS community are very similar.
Mm-hmm.
And as women, as we leave, we have this patriarchal scarcity politics.
Yes.
And the thing that I have just been so inspired and lifted by you is that you are a woman that builds other women up. And I've never seen you try to take from women. You're just always building, lifting, including me. And so I'm grateful for that. But I would ask, what advice would you have to women in our community that have similar backgrounds? We come from a patriarchal society. How do we lift one another instead of trying to compete and take one with one another?
Thank you, Lindsay, for asking that question, because it is very near and dear to my heart. And it kind of starts with those little growth monsters I was telling you about, because really raising each other up, what starts that is not comparing. The greatest, most painful part about tearing each other down is we compare one another. We compare. We think we're better than someone else, and so therefore we can put somebody else down. And it's easy for us to shame people, to just really throw that shame on them, and they're not good enough, or those little voices in our head that sit there and say, oh, you're just a little bit more beautiful, or you're just a little bit more this or that. And because those of us that are coming from a community like this where it was very patriarchal heavy, and learning how to be my own person, learning how to also honor the masculine, has been a very difficult journey. Because once again, I was tangling with the blame monster, and I wanted to blame them. I wanted to blame the masculine for all this pain that I was experiencing and the suffering. And, you know, I spent a lot of time as a single angel, because I am an angel, because it was this fight for me to figure out how to identify with the patriarch and what equality really meant. And I've come to realize that for me, equality means that I am just as connected and capable as the person next to me, whether that's male or female. I have just the same opportunities. I have just the same amount of courage if I choose to, or bravery if I choose to. And I also have the same amount of accountability. So I don't need to blame anyone. I don't need to feel better than anyone. I don't need to hate the men or the women. I just want to love. And how do you build each other up? It starts with compassion. Everyone is truly good on the inside. Even people like Warren Jeffs, I have come to adopt this idea that they are good in there somewhere. And by believing that and knowing that, it helps me to know that we can have a better future, that we can break this chain right now and say enough is enough. We can choose to be a little bit different. We can choose to honor each other as individuals and equals. We can allow people to just love no matter how they choose to love, whether that's male or female or both. They can just allow people that compassion. And most of all, compassion for ourselves. Because when you do have compassion for yourself and you do love yourself and you're on that journey, you inevitably help raise other people around you. I truly, firmly believe that. Because, you know, I was the best problem solver you could ever meet. You would be talking to me and I'd have such compassion and empathy for you. I immediately would turn into this problem solving mode where I was like, I'm going to fix you and I'm going to fix your problems and I'm going to just love you so much you can't help it. But what I wasn't doing was I wasn't doing that for myself, and that's why I was desperately searching for it from people around me. And so through this process of defining my identity, defining who I am, claiming it, owning it, and being resilient, it inevitably has helped me to learn how to lift up other women and men, both in my community. So long-winded answer, but...
Elisa, could you address what you've seen in terms of the changes in the community? I think it might be interesting to everybody to have you talk about the evolution and what's happened in the last 15 years or so.
Definitely. And if you don't mind, I absolutely love high heels. I swear, they're the worst. So don't, I'm just going to go ahead and take them off. Changes in the community. Yes, this is actually my favorite topic in the world because I love change and I get to see it every single day. So some of the changes that are most tangible within the FLDS community at this point in time is the fact that the towns are shifting so quickly. Very similar to what happened in the Texas Raid, it's not been an easy shift or change. And there's been a lot of casualties in this process. And there's been a lot of growth and learning, and it's been painful for lots of different kinds of people. But some of the most important changes that we saw that began to be catalysts was education. A couple of years ago, about 4 years ago, 4.5 years ago, Washington County School District made the incredible decision to go ahead and invest in a school in Hilldale. And this was before it made any sense. Trust me, they started with 102 students.
And that one act alone has been a catalyst that's propelled the community forward and offered people like myself the ability to move back and feel confident that my children could have an education, that I wouldn't need to be worried about what they were being exposed to. And it's also started this unconscious swirling of outside influence. And it's great because we get teachers that come from St. George and Hurricane, and they get to bond and connect with our kids and parents. And we're slowly just raising this bar of expectation with each other that says it's okay to send your children to school instead of keep them home to work. Yeah, it's good. Education is good. And teachers are good. And principals are good. We had a principal, Mr. Thomas, who was such a dear, and we just loved him so much. Sadly, he went to a new school, but we were so grateful for the 4 years he gave us. Some of the other unique changes is home ownership. Now, within the FLDS community, both in southern Utah and right on the border of Arizona and Canada, they had a trust where everyone would donate their property and their money and their assets into it because they were pursuing United Order. And through the years that this went on, because it went on for a very long time, that trust became a tool of manipulation and control. We didn't own our own homes, and so if someone was deemed unworthy and they needed to get out of town, they literally had nowhere to go because their home was not their own. And you saw it over and over and over, and families were moved and helter-skelter all over the place. And, you know, that comfort and stability that every family needs to have their home and their place was completely diminished. That has since changed. The state took over the trust several years ago with the work of a lot of people. I'm sure you've heard of the Lost Boys, and Roger Houle has been a huge tool in this change. But that one act of the state taking over the trust was very important because it halted this tool of control and manipulation that Warren and other leaders of the FLDS were using. And it kind of just halted this progress. It took a long time, and it was a painful process, but it was able to work itself out in such a way in which now the trust is being, now it's overseen by a board of people that actually live there in Colorado City and Hilldale. And since then, it's exciting. People, they've subdivided the cities, which they've never been subdivided before, and people can own their home. I own a home in Hilldale, Utah. Huge. And that has been essential because I think when someone realizes that they get to be the guardian of their own and nobody can take it from them unless they don't pay their taxes, please pay your taxes, then that was landmark in helping that. Lastly, people owning it. People accepting accountability. More and more you're starting to hear less about Warren in the community. You don't go into the grocery store or into the restaurants and hear little conversations about Warren or this or that. It's going away. Because we are bigger than Warren. We are bigger than the FLDS. We are bigger than Rulin Jeffs or Leroy Jeffs. We are our own people, and we are the people of Hilldale and Colorado City. And together, we are creating this new identity because we are redefining our community and what it means to live in Hilldale and Colorado City. We're starting to see the beauty in this incredible, gorgeous piece of desert. It's unlike anything you'll ever see. I invite you to come and visit me because you will be just as enthralled in it as I am. So those are just a few of the core changes that we've seen, but mostly the biggest change that I see is that people are making the choice for themselves. They are making the choice. Whatever it takes them to get there, whether it's people like Christine who can be an influence in their life that can start to plant seeds, or it can be my book, or it can be the evidence coming out of Texas, or it can be the fact that most of their family is already out and they just want to have their family close to them. All of these tools and all of these abilities and these opportunities are coming to the people themselves, and they are making the choice for themselves. And that is true freedom. Because I believe that freedom is when we can own and celebrate our mistakes. Because they're ours, and we make them. We're not told to make them. We're not forced to make them. We make them. And we're seeing that more and more, and I think that's the most beautiful part of this whole journey.
We'll have time for one final question.
The flip side of what's going on down in Hilldale and Colorado City is that the
FLDS people who still follow Warren were instructed by him not to cooperate with the trust so they wouldn't pay their taxes and their trustee fees. So many of them have been evicted into the surrounding communities. I live in Cedar City. So we have so many FLDS people there now. My perception is that it's actually been quite good for them.
I agree completely.
Because that they've found out that, that we outsiders are not so evil after all. And there's some people in my neighborhood, my grandchildren have played with their grandchildren.
That's
I mean, with
fantastic.
Their children. Yeah, and I would be interested in your insight, if you have any, about what's going on with the FLDS people who are still faithful.
Yes. Oh, this is a tough topic for me because I have such compassion for what these people are going through. You have to realize my mother is still deep in it. I haven't spoken to her in years. You know, I have a brother who's battling bone marrow cancer right now, and he, in his lowest moments, the only thing he wanted was to have a conversation with my mother. And she chose not to. She actively said no. And so I have this gut-wrenching realization that there are people that are still so entrapped in this, that are still so in the clutches and the shackles of the dogma of the FLDS and these belief systems that they hold dear to their heart, that it causes them to make choices that are not their own. Because I don't believe that my mother would really make that kind of a choice. And because these people are still being manipulated, they truly are still being manipulated. The problem still exists. Terrible things are still happening, and that's why we aren't giving up, because it doesn't have to be this way. It truly doesn't. We don't have to evict them, but there's this limbo mode where there has to be a sense of accountability, and you know the trust and these systems that are put in place to try and create some sense of order within the community of the FLDS and the towns does start to impact the people. But I agree with you. There's a part of me that I'm actually really excited that they're getting the opportunity to go out and experience. They really are. Every day you guys come in contact with them in Cedar City or wherever in the grocery store, and you choose to actually just smile at them. You're planting seeds, and those seeds absolutely will grow. And I am a testament of that, because the seeds of people smiling at me and being kind to me and being able to watch that family be happy, that's what led me to here where I am today, to claim my freedom and to choose to be me. So thank you for bringing that out, because I agree. That's the one bright side of this whole saga, is I keep thinking that it's good. It's good. The women are out there getting jobs and interacting with other women and getting to make that slow process. The exciting thing about it is it's not so brutal to leave the FLDS anymore. It's not this like brutal reentry into society that's overwhelming and can shatter you completely. It's kind of a slow process, and I find that rather exciting. So I know she said last question, but I like to do things a little different, as you can see. And traditionally, when a speaker is finally done speaking, then we applaud them. And that's our way of saying thank you. But I want to do it a little different today. I want you to bring to mind a moment where you battled those monsters. A moment that you redefined yourself, that you reclaimed something lost. A moment that you chose to be resilient. And I want us together to stand and take this moment to applaud that moment, to applaud that part of you that chooses to be you. So please, if you'll just take a minute, you don't have to stand, but just applaud that with me. Thank you for the honor of being able to speak my truths. Thank you for listening. Thank you for this time and space. I know you could be anywhere, and your time is valuable, so I appreciate it. So please, honor yourself.